just in time. I'll tell you what, I would have, if I hadn't got my headphones tangled there, it'd have been 30 seconds early, and that would have been like not quite accurate enough for me.
Yeah, yeah. I like to have a bit more buffer. Like, I've learned to be at least a minute before. Like, on Zooms, I'm always there sitting there before the host actually gets on, and they're usually quite shocked that there's somebody waiting there. From I should actually practice staring them out. Like, maybe look at my watch or something and pretend to be annoyed. but I'm not usually. I realize that I don't like to be late anymore, even though my friends will tell you that I had like a long-term kind of reputation for always being late, but that's no longer the case. I've realized that's just wasting everyone's time. So yeah,
I'm gonna be honest, and like half the people listening are probably people who are late, because about half the people I know are people who are late. It's just selfish.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's prioritizing.
Just, people thinking that they're more important, their time's more important than somebody else's. And I know this from I'm not gonna say who she is, but a very close member of my family. who is always late for everything, and she hates waiting for other people, and she hates waiting for other people, and the reason for it is because she's so busy and she thinks that she shouldn't be waiting for anybody else and everybody should wait for her, or like, you know, maybe not that they should wait for her, but she can't abide being late at people being late, so she ends up being late for everybody else.
Yeah, that's exactly how it starts. It's basically the person who's always late doesn't like to wait. Therefore they're always just on time, but that means they're always late for everyone else, and it's like, yeah, you're just causing everyone else to cascade down the lateness. So super annoying. Anyway, listen, we're live, everybody. Welcome to Facebook Brain Food Live on air. I say Facebook because I know I've screwed up the Facebook broadcast right now, but welcome to Brain Food Live on air. It's episode 118. Bringing it to you every Friday, as we always do. So we've got a fantastic show for you today. We're going to be talking about how to be a better TA leader. How many of us have ended up in leadership positions in talent acquisition without having any training whatsoever on what to do when you're in that position? How do you build a team? How do you train somebody? How do you mentor somebody? How do you make sure that you're the best possible person to lead your department? I think we are massively underschooled in doing this. And in fact, I think we fall into the habit of simply promoting and the random person who happens to be there, or the longest tenured person, and they end up sort of inheriting these positions and learning as we go, which is dangerous stuff when you've got the responsibility for other people in your department. So we've got a great show lined up for you today. Anyway, let's do a quick sound check before we crack on. I think it's only two channels today. So Crowdcast folks, can you hear me okay? Please say hello if you can. We are live streaming again on LinkedIn, I believe. So if you can hear me on LinkedIn, just give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down or something. Let me know whether you can hear me okay. So Facebook's done something really not weird, but it's been helpful but unhelpful in the sense that it says, okay, you can now schedule events. And I scheduled an event. I've done two in a row, which seemed to work. But today I did something different from the normal standard process and it hasn't worked. Very, very annoying, but no worries, we'll have to find another way to sort that out. Okay, people can hear us, which is all well and good. All right, quick word to our sponsors. Thank you very much to Owly by AMS. They are a volume management scheduling and screening software product. Great to see innovation happening out of these big recruitment staffing firms. I think they need to know, and I think they already know, they can't just be a services only business. They also have to technology and services. It's the entire thing, isn't it? Solutions is what companies are looking for. It's not just the one thing. They want the problem solved. So great to see companies that are staffing only moving into this space. Do check out Owly if you are a type of business that is handling too many volume hourly workers. So on-demand workforce, you wanted to find a way in which you want to rapidly manage a pipeline of on-demand workers, Owly might be a product you want to check out. Okay, let's go on with it. Welcome back to Adam Gordon, firstly. Good to have you back in the co-pilot seat, Adam.
Thank you very much for having me. As you can see, I've turned up dressed as Bill Berman today, or dressed as Daniel Fellows.
Did you like how many times did you think about putting that shirt on before you actually committed to it?
I actually don't think about what I'm wearing. I try and you know how Zuckerberg and like Barack Obama just have the same clothes they wear every day. I don't have that, but what I do to save time is I put on whatever I first find.
Right.
So it's a slightly same type of approach, slightly different tactics.
So you're very vulnerable to a prank by your missus, really, aren't you? Like she could just like swap out a few things and just put them at the front of the wardrobe or something, and you just stick them on because you'd have no care, and it could be all kinds of like random crap.
I mean, first time that I see myself on a Zoom or something, I will know that I'm wearing like, you know, my granny's cardigan or something like that. But yeah.
This is why I've got like five of these like plain white shirts, and essentially it's always the same thing. I can't think about it.
You're Elizabeth Holmes. You're that powerful.
Yeah, I've got a falsely projected deeper voice or something.
Yeah, fake chemistry kit through the
back. Yeah, you know, and somehow avoid jail as well. You know, I mean, she's it's like incredible.
You are well connected. You've got a lot in common with her, actually.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I've never raised £1 billion on a fraudulent business, though. I might need to give that a go at some point. Okay. Anyway, let's go to the newsletter, Adam. Did you read it last week? And if so, what was good about it, man?
Yeah, I did. And there's loads good about it as normal. I want to really quickly, given we've got a good audience today, presumably the subject is one that people are very interested in. So yeah. I just want to do a really quick public announcement, which is anybody who's looking for a head of TA job for Europe based in the UK, Netherlands, Germany, B2B company, around about 30 in the team, let me know because I can signpost you to one of my customers who's looking for somebody. Quick public service announcement. Anyway, why is everyone quitting the Wall Street Journal broadcast? Why is everybody quitting their jobs? So, enjoyed that. I think that loud and clear, the message is a lot of people are disillusioned. A lot of people have had the time because they couldn't go anywhere to think about actually what makes them happy in life. And is it making money? Is it working for a living? Is it doing a job that is not their passion for a living? Probably not. So a lot of people have had the time to really kind of think about that. A lot of people are trying something new. A lot of people are trying to work for themselves because they've had an ambition to do that. And of course, most of those won't succeed, but some of them will. So that's them out of the, you know, employed talent pool. A lot of people have just quit and they've saved money by not going on holidays, not, you know, doing things that they would normally do, like social lives and stuff. So they've got 3 months, 6 months, whatever it might be, just sitting in the bank. And they know that loads of companies are hiring. So when they come back into the workforce in 3-6 months, they've got options. So, you know, a lot of people are doing that as well. And then let me just see what else was there in there. The other one, so important, information about jobs. Yeah. Is so much more accessible than it ever has been. The amount of people, the world's so much more transparent. So you can find out about jobs and recruiters can find you more easily than they ever have done. And of course that causes us massive problems in recruitment because it's eliminated the barriers to entry and the access to the individuals.
That second point is really interesting because you're saying that the amount of information that's out there about jobs just gives job seekers like a little bit more confidence that there's stuff around. Whereas back in our day, where you're dependent on a Sunday newspaper, the Times job section, you're looking at that and you're thinking, right, this is a 2 million circulation newspaper looking at 30 jobs. It's like, you know, it's like super competition. You never saw the other jobs are out there. Web 1, internet, job board, suddenly you saw the visibility that way. But now you've got like social media as well, pushing and amplifying different types of companies talking about what they're doing. And what you just did there, like broadcasting something on spec, no plan. All of this type of stuff means that you've got loads of like signals suddenly telling you, you know what, there's opportunities in different ways. I haven't thought about that. That obviously changes job seeker behavior.
Well, it needs to change sales and marketing, you know, the sales and marketing balance within recruitment, because, people can find out about companies. They can, see what it's like to work there. They've got access to Glassdoor and Indeed reviews. They can, you know, go on Wikipedia and find out your CEO's inside leg measurement. They know everything about, you know, your organization and how to get a job there. And so the power is all with them, whereas you're right. I mean, I didn't really have the luxury of advertising in the Sunday Times. I had like 200 characters in the back of the Herald. But Friday mornings were so exciting. I'd come in and find out, like, is anybody phoning me because they've seen my 40-word advert this morning? But
yep.
You know, everything's changed. So we in recruitment need to adapt.
And the first point you made, Adam, as well, which I think is worth touching on, is this idea that we've suddenly had like mind space to think, to consider things. Whereas when you're operationally grinding it in work, 40 hours in the office, you know, 20 hours commute back home, domestic responsibilities, etc., you're so knackered. Like, there's nothing in your brain to even stop and think, right, take a look up and see. Like, you're almost in the front line all the time. You can't consider what's going on. But now, yeah, so we've had like 12 months where we step back from the coal face, so to speak. And we think, oh, maybe I don't need to be back in that grind. It's not like a welcoming thing to try and do. So I think we're looking, I think you're right. There's a permanent push. We're going to lose millions of people from the traditional workforce, let's say, but they've maybe gone on to do other things. It may not necessarily be a bad thing. They've just chosen to do different things. And some of that will be economic. Some of that won't be economic necessarily, but it is positive.
2.7% of workers in the USA quit their jobs in April. 1 month. That hasn't happened for over 20 years, that number of people just quit their jobs. You know, this thing about a mass resignation is not a like conspiracy theory. It's happened. It has happened.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And most of those are not, a lot of those have not quit one job to go to another one. They've quit a job and they're not doing one. Yep. Right now. So we've got to work so much harder to recruit.
No doubt. And recruiters are going nuts as well. I don't know whether you've seen the Loom I posted the other day about how many recruiting jobs going into one of the newsletters next week. There's 100 recruiting jobs going in. I've spent like 3 hours like cutting and pasting these things in. I'm like, I don't want to be doing this.
Set up a job board.
I'm gonna do a job board. I've hinted at it. But ultimately, what I'm doing now, trying to provide these jobs to people, it literally is not effective because I look at that list. There's 100 jobs. How are you supposed to go through that? That doesn't make any sense. And that's only from like 7 companies. So you've got, it's like ridiculous growth. And there's thousands upon thousands of these TA jobs going. No one can recruit them. Someone, by the way, should be setting up some sort of TA boot camp where you career change people from a non-recruitment career into a recruitment career and start making some more recruiters. Because I think we have a global shortfall. I really do. So anyway, that's beside it. Anyway, moving on quickly, Adam, we're tuning up time. So give us one more from last week. That was interesting.
Well, one more. Okay. This idea, which I'm really concerned about. So I think in recruitment, we probably get a false sense of what people actually want in the world, because a lot of people in recruitment have got quite, liberal kind of views on things. And, you know, they're quite in tune with like, actually what might be a better way of doing things, but a lot of people don't necessarily want that, and we don't realize it, so we're in a bit of a bubble here. But this concept of remote work, and we talked about it a lot on here, I'm a little bit concerned about Gen Z, and I read the article which said that Gen Z are worried about getting left behind because they learn by listening to people around them. And, you know, if they're trying to learn how to be an accountant from home, or how to be in advertising, or how to be an actuary, or how to be in, you know, a civil engineer, and they're not getting what we got when we were younger, which is soaking up so much stuff just all around us all day, just being in the environment, this is a big problem. And I'm getting to the point now where I think all of that talk, probably round about last year up until maybe not that long ago, about, yeah, of course, we're going to be moving to remote working and almost everybody's going to be doing it or whatever. I don't think it is, because there are a lot of big benefits in working in an office that you miss out from, or working on site, should we say, if you miss out from.
Here's the thing, man. I think remote work is suitable for a veteran employee.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great.
It's great. So everyone's everyone, similar kind of bracket of veteranness, right? So if you've been in there working for 10, 20 years or whatever, of course, the last thing you want to do is commute. You've got your own stuff set up. You've got your life outside. You've got, you know, you've got probably control your own home environment as well. You've got a nice office, all those types of things that are available. Remote working is perfect for us. However, if you're like a graduate just coming into the first, your world of work for the first time, you have no idea what to do. You are wanting, you're going to be wanting to be in an office. There's another report coming out, which again has a very stark generational divide in between whether remote is the optimal or remote is not the optimal. And again, it's the younger generation coming in that's saying they want to be in an office. So it's going to be very interesting. We're going to come to a point as businesses where we have to decide what kind of company we want to be. Do we want to be a veteran-only business? I think that's okay to do as well. You know, if you're, you know, running a software house, you're running something of different types, sure, you can just be veteran. Or do you want to grow your own? Do you want to recruit up and develop? If so, maybe you can't do the work from anywhere. Maybe you can't even do hybrid, because what does that mean? Only the young people in the office and, you know, old people out of it? You know, question mark. Need to think about it.
No, it's true. Just on a quick anecdote about, you know, people of like, you know, our age and above who have, you know, established, you know, themselves in their career to an extent. Working from home is good. A very good friend of mine works for Google. He's in their games, but he basically runs their games business in the UK. And he posted something on Facebook the other day, which showed a picture of his setup at home, which is basically in South London. Basically like the Starship Enterprise. It's like this amazing kind of work from home setup he's got. And then he went into the office for his first day and he took a picture of this sad little desk with his little laptop and like a plastic cup of water or something like that. And it wasn't as good.
Good point. I mean, you'll degrade. I mean, you look at people's, especially people in gaming, they've got like $1,000 desk chair or something. They've got all a kit in there and they go into the office and it's some sort of like, you know, half mangled Regis thing. It's like, come on, it's not where it's all at. And by the way, Steve,
Regis, by the way, that's who my wife works for.
I do beg your pardon. I love Regis. The only reason why I say this is I remember being in a few offices back in the day that were not, we were obviously budget end at the point at that time. Anyway, Steve Wars just said Universum's Gen Z research. If you have that report, Steve, share it in a chat stream. I'd love to see that. I think other people would love to see it as well. All right, let's get on with this.
53% said they're worried about being isolated.
That's right. That's all about social capital. It's all about networking. If you have a weak network, professional network, you're going to want to be in an office. Okay, let's get on with this because we're talking about leadership here. TA leadership, Adam. I think you've actually been a TA leader, haven't I? I keep
not leader, no.
Were you head of talent at some place or?
No, I wasn't. No? I was a consultant in human resource services at PwC. And I did some internal TA, but I did a lot of external type stuff, working with customers to help them. But I didn't lead a TA team.
Totally irrelevant experience. No, very seriously though, let's bring on our guests and let's talk about this because I do want to discover if you're the journey I want to explore today is if you're a person that is stepping into a leadership position for the first time, like what do you need to know in order to succeed there? And let's speak to some folks that have been in that position before, and we'll see how they get on. So we're gonna please send Hung your resume, Adam. And it's full of lies.
Isn't it? I don't know why I'm ever invited on here. He doesn't think I've got any relevant experience for anything.
Full of lies.
I'd like to address something you said a minute ago, though. Before we start talking about the brain food around TA leaders, and you know, one thing I definitely see is talent acquisition. Talent acquisition people are appointed to leadership roles much more based on merit than they are in a staffing agency setting where people are often promoted based on being billers, which is clearly zero relevant experience for being a leader. And I think that in typical employers, they're a lot better at understanding the difference between a high-performing individual contributor and somebody that is actually a leader. So I don't think just like the person who recruits the most call center workers becomes the director of TA. I don't think it does work like that normally.
I reckon that's probably true, but it's it's probably, or you're comparing probably the worst industry for promotion of management talent, because I think recruitment is that. There is no worse business that does it, simply because if you're the top biller, you simply inherit a team. And that's basically what happens. So it's a low bar. But let's explore it in a bit of detail. Okay, we've got some cool people on. Let's go. Let's do some intros. Jane Redden. Jane, who are you? Quickly introduce yourself.
Hi, Hung. I'm Jane Redden. I'm the talent director at Albion VC. And I have spent 25 years, for my sins, either being a recruiter, a recruitment leader, or a hiring coach.
Fantastic, and great to see you back on the show, Jane. Let's go to Paul next. Paul, welcome, and who are you? Quickly introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm Paul Maxson. For the last 5 years, I've been doing my own consultancy work for a vehicle called Maxson Talent. You can see what I did there. I've had over 30 years worth of talent and talent acquisition experience in senior roles through PwC, Unilever, Financial Conduct Authority, and then since I've been doing my own stuff, a variety of organizations from Zalando to NHS England.
Fantastic. Amazing experience. And we'll really look forward to seeing your views on all of this, Paul. And Elaine, great to see you. Can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you and what is you do?
Yeah, sure. So Elaine Atkinson, I've been in talent acquisition for 17 years now across different industries, different organizations. I've done search, I've done in-house, I've done RPO, everything from early careers up to exec hiring. The conversation earlier really resonated with me because I'm actually on a sabbatical myself, taking some time to do some open water swimming this summer and do a bit of study again before I get into my next gig. So yes, great to be here.
Fantastic. Did you say open water swimming, Elaine?
I am, yes. The sun has hit Northern Ireland, so it's warm enough to get in now.
Is it? It's always freezing. It's like you're going to need global warming, like a crank up a few more degrees before you catch me in
the
waters.
Well, the Irish are hardy, Hung, though. And so the Scottish, you'll know that, Adam.
I'm trying to establish a link between open water swimming and your crocodile rock top. Crocodiles that you don't want to be swimming with.
Do you remember when Rock was young?
Me and Susie had so much fun.
Yeah.
Holding hands and skimming stones.
Oh, here we go. It's gone off now.
My goodness. I wonder what... we are. I'm going to pretend I don't understand the lyrics just to see if I can get away with being a bit younger than these guys. But I'm not really. I'm actually very old. So I understand everything you're saying. Okay. Let's get on with the topic, folks. We're talking about how to be a better TA leader. Now, I've come up with this with just a conjecture to say, you know what? I've seen a lot of people simply become head of TA because startup needs to hire somebody. They've just hired the first recruiter in. And of course, they're the head of talent. They're the only person there. And then 6 months down the line, they're managing a team of 10 and there's a 500-person business. And it's like, who's supporting that head of TA who has no experience as to the job of leading a department, managing a team. Firstly, what do you think of that premise? Is that, would you say it's fair, or do you think I've just like exaggerated it for comic effect? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I've seen it in Jane's world quite a lot. And I don't mean Jane. I've seen it happen in startups and scale up companies quite a lot, where somebody's appointed as a recruiter and then they go from a job title of recruiter to a job title of head of talent, which basically means chief people officer in that type of environment. And then they've got to build other things out and they don't have any relevant experience or necessarily the personal characteristics to do it. But I've not really seen it much in corporates. But Jane, I'm interested to know, because you were nodding what I said. They end up needing somebody like you because they've made the wrong appointment into that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So for those that don't know, I joined Balderson Capital in 2012, and there's 100 startups in that organisation, and then I work at Albion, where there's 70 startups and a little bit of time at EQT in between. So overall, I've been both the recruiting leader at Balderson, where I recruited the internal team, and for the fund, and also advised and helped more than 100 startups in their building their talent acquisition capability. And I would completely agree, it's the most impactful thing that I've done or been a part of doing. when you become a recruiting leader is to embed a hiring culture of sharing the responsibility for hiring. And that means, you know, building that hiring mindset, that muscle across the whole organization. And it's a really interesting journey because I came from a search firm where I'd been basically responsible for client service. The client service mindset was prevalent. And then I became a recruiter and I was measured on how good I am at hiring myself. And then you become a recruiting leader and you're not measured on how well you recruit, but how we all recruit or how everybody else recruits. And so you've got to change your mindset. And the owner mindset that really shifted in me was when I started to ground down into my own integrity as a recruiting leader. And, you know, and that owner mindset, which is that I've got a seat at the table, but I'm part of a team. And as a team, we're all responsible for making these hires. We're all responsible for, you know, and include the business leaders, right, as well as the people, at, you know, the other talent acquisition folk in the team. And so how you do that is then a factor of evangelizing the why. So why is it important that, you know, we all share the responsibility for candidate experience? Why is it important that we all share the responsibility?
Let me interrupt you, Jane, because I think there's one thing I want to just underline. I think that transition from customer service mindset is one of the main things. I mean, it blew my mind straight away because most recruiters are born in the agency world, were trained to deliver to customers. That is like ingrained in us. It would be very hard, in fact, to become a successful agency recruiter without having that service delivery That's mindset. Right.
Yeah.
But then you're saying that actually, but the difference between a standard recruiter internally and a person recruitment leader is that you need to get away from the service side of it. You're not just delivering to customers. What you need to do is to try and develop the recruiting function for the business, recruiting capacity for the entire business. Yeah, that's an interesting transition.
I was just going to make one further point, and yeah, definitely. You know, for me, it's when I work with hiring leads, as you say, Adam, they're the only person in house in talent acquisition, and then they get a team, you know, 5 or 7 or 10, and they're doubling the headcount of their business every 6 months. You know, I say to them, well, how many mandates are you're currently hiring for? And they say, I don't know, 15. I'm like, well, like you've got, so in, to be the recruiting leader, you have to start to work on talent acquisition, not in talent acquisition. And that means really looking at the talent acquisition strategy and how you're going up and out into your business. And, you know, the first step on that is reduce it, as painful as it is, measured on that, again, in both an agency environment and indeed in an IC and an individual contributor role. And how you shift from that starts with, you know, stopping doing all of the mandates so that you free up time to be the leader.
Okay, final, yeah, final
I think there's,
go ahead, Paul.
Something around. No, I think I agree with all of that. And I also think that talent acquisition / recruitment is probably one of the worst sectors at developing others. Be they, you know, time and time again, I saw from the agency world way back in the 80s where the most senior, most the best billers were put into management positions without having the framework or the without being set up for success as management or as a manager or as a leader. And, you know, in big corporates, the same can apply. But I also think just to put a spanner in the works as such, but to be slightly, an attempt to being slightly controversial, is that we often confuse authority with leadership. So by authority, I mean, you know, that could be a CEO, a line manager, your parents, where they're present, they feel our pain, they calm us down. You know, we reward people in talent acquisition, but more broadly for figuring out what's expected, doing it competently, and then paying them. But that's not exercising leadership. And actually, we call them leaders, and that's not exercising leadership. We confuse authority with leadership. Leadership is non-hierarchical and can be utilized all the way across. And that's Sometimes it's a little risky. Sometimes it's a little bit hard. It can mean choosing the right moment to say to somebody in a non-hierarchical way, be they within your team or be they within the business, saying, you know, we're often telling people what they want to hear as opposed to what they need to hear. And sometimes we need to choose the moment, which is a leadership opportunity across the hierarchical spectrum, to invite resistance from somebody by telling them or saying to them what they need to hear, and asking people to give up a little bit of what they've relied on in the past and the present. Because without that, it becomes much more challenging to deliver change. We will just keep on replicating what we've been replicating, albeit in slightly different environments with different tools, but in the same way, ad infinitum, and we won't be growing as a capability organizationally for talent acquisition, but also functionally as well, unless we encourage leadership through that challenge right the way across hierarchies.
You know what, that's a really interesting kind of way to describe it, Paul. The idea that leadership is kind of either a behavior or a trait rather than a status or a title. And it could be activated. Anybody could demonstrate leadership in different contexts and irrespective of the hierarchy. That's probably something we could train, probably something at least we could develop or encourage. And maybe that's something we should focus on as kind of the next thing to talk about. Like if you saw somebody that had the ambition, let's say, of developing beyond individual contributor, how do we cultivate leadership in that person? Any thoughts on that, Elaine? Go to you on this. Where you've got, maybe you've identified a few people that you think, you know what, here's a growth path for this person. How do you encourage that sort of leadership behavior to emerge?
Yeah, because I think there's two differences here. There's the sort of experience you need to succeed in TA and the capabilities that you need, and then there's the leadership traits that you have. And I think more and more, and I don't think this is just TA, I think this is across the board in organizations now, that you need to have that, you need to be able to embrace uncertainty, because that is going to be the only constant, and be able to pivot. I think you need to be curious, you need to have great learning agility, and particularly as a leader of teams, you need to have vulnerability. And what I mean for that, and my experience of that, is being, you know, knowing that you don't have all of the answers, really understanding what your own strengths and your values are and your purpose, and then hire great people that complement your strengths and weaknesses, support them and empower them in the roles and give them the stretch opportunities even before they're ready for them, and then really just get out of the way. And that all sounds like easy things to do, but in a role, particularly in the corporate world where I was, where you're under pressure, there's always this tension between supply and demand. They are hard traits to practice in reality. And I think some of the best people that I've worked with or have the potential to be leaders of the future really understand themselves really well and want to work on those softer skills, because the other things I think you can learn. And the other things that I think are really important as TA starts to shift, you have to have great digital skills and being able to combine tech and automation. You've got to think about human-centered experiences, so everyone has a positive experience regardless of the outcome as a candidate. And you need to be marketeers in the future. So you're, you know, driving brand advocacy, even compliance internally from the hiring managers. So there's a lot that you have to think about, and it's how do you balance all of those things in the leaders of the future. But a lot of this, I think, you can learn or train people in, but you have to have that learning agility, would be my take.
Elaine, can everybody be trained to be a leader? Because my immediate instinct is absolutely not. But I'm interested to know what you think.
Well, I think everyone can practice leadership. You can have leaders at all levels, but you will get people who gravitate more to leading teams and wanting to coach, develop, and mentor people. You can have individual contributors that still show leadership traits, and they need to, but I suppose it's a choice then in terms of what you want to be doing day to day. But I do believe everyone can cultivate those traits.
All right, I want to hear from the crowd here. I think this would be it's a very interesting philosophical debate. What do you think, folks? Is it possible for everyone to be a leader, or are there certain people with traits that yes, this person is a leader? I am actually on the kind of Neanderthal side of it. I think yes, absolutely. Certain people are born this way; they're going to be leadership characters. Other people, you'd never put them in a leadership position, or they would be poor at it. And then there's a bunch of people in the middle that kind of can manage it, can hold the fort for a period of time. But you know what? May not be a naturally good fit to there either. Let me know in the chat stream or in comment. What do you think? Are leaders born or made? I want to know. Okay, go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, no, sorry. Oh, God, too many thoughts. somewhat controversially, while we're throwing controversial kind of comments in here, I think there's a distinct difference between leadership and management.
Or leadership. Down the chat.
That's not controversial, Jane. That's like
consensus. Exactly that.
Well, yeah, good. So I can explain what I think the difference is, or certainly what I define it inside me, if that's helpful. A leader takes decisions. It takes decisions and makes decisions with compassion. A leader sets direction. They work on the vision, the strategy. It's like a giant leap. They kind of go, right, this is where we're heading. We're going to sail to America. And it tends to be kind of forward looking, big strides, clear. Being clear on strategy is really important. That's a leadership trait. Uh-huh. A management trait is all about the other person. So am I understanding what's going on for you? It's baby steps along the journey. Like, how are you now on this journey? How can I enable you to be your best self here? How can I listen? How can I be in service of you? It's not about me at all. It's about how I can enable you as your manager to be your best self. And so it's very different.
That's a good conception. Although looking at Elaine's sort of body language, micro expressions, I reckon she's going to kick off here. Yeah, it's like, do you want to say something on that, Elaine?
Well, I suppose, most people in their career, they may start as an individual contributor, as a recruiter, and then they become a team lead and then a manager. And then through failure, setback, overcoming obstacles, they become a leader. In the sort of corporate sense of the word. So they are developing on a continuum. So I still think that is possible, but you're learning different skills at different stages of your journey. So it's not one or the other, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, it's basically modes. It's different modes. And I totally agree. It's not one thing or the other. But you can be in different modes, right?
And you can also have... You can actually have great leaders that are terrible managers as well.
Yeah.
The visionary leader, which these days we don't like to, compliment in any way, but the visionary leader that goes out there and just has the vision and says, we're doing this, folks, doesn't give a damn about EQ or whatnot, my way or the highway, nevertheless has done, dragged people or dragged the organization in that direction. That is leadership. Even if the outcome is terrible, you could drag them into a terrible situation, but the leadership is still there. You can't deny that. I would say, I'd cite someone like Donald Trump. I would say a terrible human being. I have no question about saying that. However, I can't deny he's a leader. He's literally dragged like 100 million people in a certain direction. And I psychically done it, emotionally done it. That's amazing leadership. Terrible manager, terrible person, but he's got leadership traits.
So I mean, not.
Well, I'll say it's.
Go ahead, Pop.
I know there are people from other countries on this, but I just give it from a parochial to the UK perspective, an example of the difference between authority and leadership and where it can go wrong. So, and it's following on from your Trump analogy. So Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, continually goes demonstrates authority by telling people what they want to hear, which is why you continually get these U-turns and flip-flops to use whether they're playing off party factions against each other or telling the electorate in some ways, or the half of the electorate that like him, what they want to hear. And as a consequence of that, he has misrepresented numerous things in the UK Parliament. That's authority. Leadership was Dawn Butler yesterday, who's an opposition MP, who called him out on several things and said that he was a liar. Unparliamentary language when you're not debating the individual, and she was thrown out for the day. But what she did in getting noticed and pushing the boundaries was demonstrating leadership. And that's why I'm a huge advocate of creating environments and encouraging. Doesn't mean everyone's going to one day, you know, run an organization or run a department or be a CEO. But if you can encourage leadership throughout, because it's non-hierarchical, and get that environment to challenge and call things out and be like, you know, babies are, where they demonstrate, they try and sort of step over the boundaries of what they're allowed to do. And they keep on going and keep on going until they get snapped back. And the way to create more and be more creative is to continually have an environment where you push the boundary until you get slapped back. That way, you've actually started to achieve more rather than remain totally within your sphere. I'm mixing a couple of metaphors up.
Don't worry.
Paul, can I just ask?
You got me on that from Trump.
No, your point, Paul, just your point about Boris Johnson is an interesting one, because I am definitely no Boris Johnson fan. However, and I recognize what you said about him acting with authority, but I can't think of any way that I would, much as I dislike this guy, I can't think of any reason to say he is not also a leader, because I think he demonstrates a lot of leadership a lot of the time. Well, look at when he was the mayor of London, he galvanized a massive amount of followers, and he did in Brexit as well, like the Brexit campaign. Think of the amount of followers that he developed. You don't develop followers unless you're a leader. You might not have been your leader.
All right.
But
yeah.
I think
right.
It's difficult to say he's not a leader.
All right. I throw my comment. I think you're right. I'm loath to say anything positive about Boris Johnson, because he's yet another person of the same ilk as Donald Trump is.
Adolf Hitler was a leader. Like,
let's not go there. Okay. We're not going there. Let's spool this back a little bit and look at TA leadership. In terms, I get what Paul is saying. Like, I think, Paul, what you're saying is what you want to do is actually disperse leadership across the business rather than kind of centralize it in the personality of one person. And I totally get that as a very positive thing to try and do. So let's have a look at how you do that. And in fact, how do you encourage people to demonstrate those traits, or how do you learn them? Because I'm thinking that the primary audience that's paying attention to this might be folks that are struggling in a leadership position right now, for instance. They may have sort of found themselves, I'm now managing this bunch of people or this department. No one's showing me how to do it. Like, how do they find help to do that? I mean, are there resources? Are there groups? I mean, how do we point these folks in the right direction? Do you have any sort of insights in any of this, you three?
I did some leadership development. I think leadership development is a work in progress, and it's something that I'm continuously investing in. I did a really good leadership program last year to big up a lady called Sharon Peak. She runs a leadership development program for women leaders. And it was amazing. It helped me to cultivate authenticity. It helped me to cultivate confidence. It helps me, I think what you articulated there brilliantly, Paul, is, how do you manage conflict well in healthy conflict in a team? One of the most powerful things that we did as an exercise in that was, can you build your own sort of personal brand, like your personal leadership brand? And I spent a bunch of time working on this, and my own virtues, my own leadership virtues are practical candor, energizing thinking, analytical tenacity. And what it really made me think about is I can be deliberate about how I'm showing up as a leader in work, in my life. And, those sort of cultural values, just to give an example of, kind of how I want to show up as a leader, is something that I learned through her. So, massive. Oh, yes. Steve always said, yes, Sharon Peak. She's really worthwhile. But there's loads of leadership coaching you can do, loads of leadership development that really worked for me.
Okay, so quick question for Paul and Elaine. Have you two been, have you done any coaching? Has anyone trained you or mentored you in terms of leadership back in the day or even recently? And if so, what did you learn from that experience? Or maybe if not,
I'm going to sort of hold it back, go back to the Gen Z point that Adam was making earlier, and in terms of the risks and opportunities. I've been around the block a few times, but what I had from, you know, Michael Page, PwC, Unilever, etc., as I was growing, I had the opportunity to observe and listen, and through lived experience, which, you know, I know we call it the 70-20-10, whatever, but the 70 is very much a lived experience, and a sense of feeling and well-being and how you've been led, and when it's been done well, because you can see what outcomes are within teams and organizations, and when it doesn't work. So there is, going back to that, the risk of, you know, remote first or continued remote, particularly for coming in and maturing in the workplace, then that's a challenge, or more of a challenge. And I can give some specific examples of poor managers and leaders. I can remember one person saying, congratulating me because I made her look good. She was my boss to her boss. Whereas actually, if we're distributing and allowing leadership and people to grow, then, you know, far better to give the platform for the person that's actually doing the work, and you know, allowing them 2-3 steps up to be showcased for doing so. A good talent acquisition leader is often identifies people that are better than themselves. That's probably you know, nurtures them, invests in them. In terms of formal training, I probably didn't get as much of that until I actually got to the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. And, you know, I've been in some sort of fairly big ticket organizations prior to that. And then I was put on a course of leadership at SIDE. A lot of what I learned through that was the sort of the 20 or 10. And I could recommend a guy called Marty Linsky. You can see him on TED or TEDx talks, talking about leadership, 15-20 minutes. And, you know, he looks a bit like a cadaver, but he says some really, really good stuff. Some of the examples that he gives are out of date, but the principles behind them could be better served with more up-to-date examples. So I recommend Martin Linsky.
Yeah, Paul, do you mind like maybe fishing out one of those TED Talks and sharing a link in the chat stream? I think that would be really useful for the crowd to take a look at. Okay, go to you, Elaine. Sort of any sort of memorable moments or where someone's imparted leadership knowledge to you in your career today?
Yeah, look, I've been fortunate. I've had some great managers in my career that I've learned from that have pushed me forward to take on things maybe that I wasn't ready for. But equally, I've had mentors, I've had coaches throughout my career, which have been hugely valuable. And I think some of the things I've learned from that is, and I mentioned it earlier, is just being really super clear on what your strengths are, what your values are, what you're good at. And use that a bit as your, you know, your guiding light in your career, because you can get swayed a lot by other people's opinions or the right or the wrong way to do things. And I'd say to anyone who's becoming a TA leader in my team, you've got to take a little bit from all of the leaders and the books that you've read and develop your own leadership style so you can be really authentic in who you are. Because if you're authentic, I generally feel you have much better career, you have more enjoyment from the job, but it's not easy to do that. I mean, I read a lot as well, a lot of leadership books, I listen to podcasts. I definitely recommend Dare to Lead by Brené Brown to anyone on the call who hasn't read the book or listened to the podcast. I get a lot from her. She talks a lot about self-acceptance, being vulnerable, being authentic, and that's got me through some tough spots. But actually, I've learned more, not so much from the advice, but from the doing, from the failing, from getting it wrong with team members or clients or stakeholders. And then, you know, learning from that and applying that learning. So I'm a big fan of all of those sorts of things, but there's no magic bullet. You've got to do a bit of everything.
Let's the two of you have now mentioned this idea that actually learning the leadership on the job and in the experiential part of it is important. So maybe my premise was incorrect in the sense, oh, I'm thinking we're not supporting these people, but actually, you know, you need to just throw them in there. What does the remote world do for us in this case then? Let's say, you know, a lot of this learning was learning at desk. Paul, you mentioned listening in, like, you know, from, you know, it wasn't a private, it was probably a private conversation, well, but you were in the earshot, right? So how
listening,
how
listening and watching and, you know, and I still hear myself say, and I do say it to people with, on occasion now, you know, we have, two eyes, two ears, and one mouth for a reason. You know, that it's about listening and observing and having the opportunity to do that.
Well, in the context of remote working, Paul, and to all of you three, actually, what do we need to think about if we're now moving to a distributed world of working? Everything's like default asynchronous for a start. Like, how much leadership am I going to get reading a document? You know, I don't have that synchronicity and that synchronous flow of information osmotically, if I can use that word, you know, coming at me. Everything is kind of more structured. How does that affect leadership?
From my side, what I know to be true is that I deliberately put networking time, relationship building time onto my diary every single week. It's part of, you know, it's part of my role. It's you have to reach out and, you know, it's a bit more mechanical, but, you know, finding moments to, you know, to connect and to genuinely collaborate with people on the screen is as important, you know, it's more important, you know, now that you make the space to cultivate that. You can't just, I mean, I'm a task oriented, highly goal oriented individual, and I it's quite a struggle for me to do that every week because I'm, you know, desperate to just complete my OKRs and, you know, get the task done. But actually, it's the who and the how and how they feel as well in part of, you know, in that collaboration with me. And so the relationship building, the working on talent acquisition, the working on the stakeholders that really need to be feeling as if they're part of the journey that you're taking them on is important work every single week.
Well, one of the aspects of leadership is actually improving the team's performance by dint of your leadership, right? And a big part of that may be, you know, this, so the building of the relationships with the team you're leading. You can't just assume they're automata that are going to, you know, deliver this fixed sort of set of value. You need to cultivate them and build them up and help them develop.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, folks, we're running short on time.
Go on, Paul. So just sort of one thing, I apologize, just to, in terms of how I've adapted in the last sort of year, 18 months, you know, former and, you know, as is and now. I used to get slightly miffed if I was at meetings and it didn't have an agenda and there weren't itemized and sometimes minutes taken and actions. And I think in a completely virtual world, it's important to have a few meetings each week with actually without an agenda, without action, so you can actually have conversations with people. You know, the only way you can listen, it's listening and observing, or, you know, meeting people at the for a coffee or at the cafe or the coffee machine or whatever that you used to do, kind of doesn't happen now. So the only way that you can chew the fat, and often chewing the fat used to spark ideas and conversation and generate some kind of cohesion and collaboration. So we have to do those virtually. And so for me, it's important to actually have a meeting with a bunch of people with no agenda and talk shit for 20 minutes or half an hour, out of which comes stuff.
The other thing, I'm cutting across the lane here, but the other thing that was a huge lever for success for me at Balderson when I first got there is that I was clearly able to do this in the real world. But I had a mandate to just go and look and listen, and so I rocked up to all the operating meetings, the IC meetings, the investor, you know, the operating calls, and I came out of talent acquisition in order to try it. Well, interested in understanding was the decision-making psyche. How did we make decisions as an organization? And I wanted to try and adapt that and pull that into the way that we made decisions in talent acquisition. And it was a hugely successful lever because it created this, again, this sort of shared responsibility. And so if you're a new talent acquisition leader and you're in a virtual environment, you know, find the sponsorship to go and spend time, not in the talent acquisition meetings, but in the operating calls, in the operating team meetings, in the, you try and get underneath the skin of how your business actually makes decisions. Definitely pays forward in my view.
Any thoughts on your side, Elaine, with regards to leadership in this new remote world? I mean, have you had any kind of, I guess, sense that it will change and what we need to do as potential leaders needs to also change?
I'm a big fan of balance. I mean, I don't think the old world necessarily worked for everyone either. I had regional team members who felt left out. I had mothers in my team who were rushing to leave their kids off at school and felt like they were failing on both fronts. So in a way, the pandemic level the playing field a little bit, but in the new world we won't hopefully be in lockdown, and it'll be a different type of, what I'm a big fan of is the hybrid working. So how do you balance giving people the flexibility to integrate their lives into work and motivate them and engage them still to do a great job, and balance being at home and being in the office? And I think there are answers there, and you have to take into account the different generations. And it's not going to be easy, and it might throw the whole world of HR on its head, but it's coming. It's the future. Technology's already radically shifted how we do TA. So I am very optimistic that we can find a new hybrid approach that's going to suit the majority of people, but it's going to be looking at people as individuals, and then how do you then do policies or legislate for that, which is going to be the tricky piece. But I think we'll find a way.
We need to move quickly to the, there's a couple of questions I want to get to, so I want to just jump straight to them, folks. Can you give us a personal example of a kind of a leadership mistake you made, and, you know, what you learned from that? Because I think sometimes you talk about experiential learning, the experiences you learn from is when you've made an error and you think, oh, wow, you know, that outcome totally didn't, wasn't what I expected. Let's not do that again. Any thoughts on that? Like an error you made as a leader, and you now would advise others to think again in a different way if you encountered a similar circumstance. Any thoughts on this?
I can go again. Oh, go ahead, Mark, or go ahead, Paul. No, you go, Paul. Look, very quickly, when I became the head of the function, there was a lot to do, and you're under pressure to perform, and you want people to think, you know, they made the right choice in choosing you as the leader. But I started to focus on, well, what are all the things I need to fix, and we need to get delivery right. And then when that's all good, we'll start to promote all of the good things that we're doing in the function. But as you know, in TA, there's no end state. There's no utopia. The business is constantly changing and the market is constantly changing. And so one of my learnings from this is you've got to build up some credit with the business. So even though things are maybe not working in some areas, but you're doing great stuff over here, you've got to be your own self-promoter. You've got to promote the good things so that when things do go wrong, and they inevitably will because we're working with people, you know, that perception of the function is put in the context of all of the wider things that you're doing. And that is something I didn't do when I first took on the role. And it's a learning for me to always balance the perception of the function through promotion as well as problem solving.
Really good insight, the difference between promotion and problem solving. And sometimes you can be overly focused on problem solving, which just kind of gives off a negative, you know, steam, if you like, because that's all you're doing, you're fixing stuff. You also got to understand, as some things are going well, promote that. Your departmental representative, like it or not, you know, you're the top of the business. You have to also do those things. Paul, do you want to say something real quick?
Yeah, a couple of things just in terms of a few years ago, making a couple of knee-jerk decisions based on what I kind of saw as is without doing a proper diagnostic. One, trying to break the whole Indian recruitment cycle for graduate recruitment in India, because I thought we could be different. That was an impossible task, certainly to do in the way that I did it. And the other, in terms of a knee-jerk reaction, again, without doing the proper diagnostic, was at the same organization, which was deciding we needed it's a few years ago, deciding we needed a different ATS for, again, for graduate recruitment. And really, it was a knee-jerk reaction because I wanted to do something as quick as possible in an organization where getting change done is often like trying to turn the oil tanker. And I hadn't done an appropriate diagnostic. Sometimes you need to stay on the balcony enough and do the diagnostic for the problem that you want to solve. And that was a lesson learnt the hard way, which I hold both hands up to, and had to do so at the time.
You know, Paul, that also takes courage sometimes to be on the balcony for a while, doesn't it? Because sometimes you feel like there's action orientation, go, go, go. But in fact, what you need to do sometimes is take a step and, you know what, we're not ready to make any movement right now. We need to still do the information collection. Okay, great stuff. Go to you, Jane, real quick. One mistake you've learned.
One mistake. Well, to riff on that, I've definitely made that mistake with this action orientation. And you know, it's in a similar zone, but it's to do too much all at once. To take on too much, to try and change, take on too much all at once. It's just, you know, if you're an IC and you set a strategy and you go after a goal, you're just making decisions in and of yourself. And you know, if you're in a team and you're leading a team, you've got to collaborate and bring people with you, and it just takes longer.
Yep, it takes longer to corral them. And also, if you put too much in the pipe, your own personal pipeline, what happens is you'll be making decisions in order to just to get that pipeline clear. And it's not the best, it may not be the best decision.
And then the other thing I realize is that it's like, I didn't spend enough time asking what's the one thing that's going to move the needle? What's going to move the needle? What people, other people think, you know, outside of our function, it is the one thing that matters most. And so, yeah, ask that question regularly. And it's really interesting what you get back, because it's probably not what you think, or it certainly isn't what I think. And I've definitely made that mistake.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, listen, folks, we have to jump. I mean, this is obviously, we need a part two on this, maybe even a series, because I think we've barely scratched the surface of what we're talking about here in terms of, like, I want to talk about how to fake leadership, because I'm a believer you can fake it. You literally have a checklist of things you can do. Just do them against your personal characteristics and people start thinking you're a leader.
If it works, you are a leader. You can't fake leadership. You either do it. By copying somebody, or you do it.
But this is what I mean. Like, some people here are saying, and I initially said, yeah, leaders are born. Actually, no, it's a checklist of things you do. And if you kind of are consistent with it, yes, Adam, it is. I'll show you. I'm just thinking about my time when I was a football manager in the Sunday League. I was no leader. Guarantee you, my personality is not. I'm far too lazy to be a leader, right? I'd rather be laying on a beach somewhere. Don't need managing people. Don't need that. But I had to for the responsibility for this football club. God damn it! And I ended up just like committing to certain things against my personal instincts. But it ended up getting respect with the team. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, we'll go back to that at some other point. Yes, I'll come up with that checklist later, but we are out of time. So I just want to thank everyone for joining us. Thank you, Jane Redding. Great to see you. We'll bring you back if you're up for it. Paul Maxson, I think it's your debut on BrainFood Live. So great to see you and great to have you here. Love to get you back also.
Thanks.
And Elaine, we'll get you back if you survive your open water swimming. And, you know,
crocodiles.
Thanks, mate.
Great. Okay, you have a good break, you three.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend.
See you. Thank you.
You too. Thank you.
Okay, Adam, I think you got to go as well. Everyone's got to go. We'll see you next time. Okay, we're finished with the show, folks. I hope you've enjoyed it. I felt that was like so much more to say. We have so much more to say about this topic. We just scratched the surface of it. So I'm definitely looking forward to do a kind of a part two on this as soon as possible. And I know I say that every week, but this one, I think there's so much we can dig into, particularly I think when you talk about leadership as something that we can all practice. It doesn't necessarily need to come with the status of being, you know, the departmental head, even though, of course, that person has a lot of leadership to do. We haven't even got to the poll, for instance. I wanted to talk here about, you know, what is the single most important leadership skill for TA? And I was surprised because the decision, the one I thought was the most important, got zero votes. Check this out. Empathy, vision, expertise on domain knowledge, influence, persuasion, decision making. I think leadership's most important point is decision making. Nobody agrees with me. Not a single person agrees with me. Like 25 people voted. Okay. So anyway, we should talk about this again. If you like this show, please follow the channel. We'll be back on this next week. We are talking. What are we talking next week? Oh, we're talking about how to build social capital with software engineers. Software engineers don't like to speak to recruiters. How do we get better engagement from software engineers? We can do that by building better relationships. So how do we do that? We've got some amazing people, tech recruiters that have got some unique examples on how to build credibility with the technical community. I think it's a must watch for anybody who is a tech recruiter. So make sure you follow the channel for that. We'll be back next week. Okay, that's about it. You enjoy your weekend, everybody. We'll see you soon.